طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we return to an examination of censorship issues on U.S. campuses and feature a fascinating panel of speakers from the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs Conference held in March of 2018. Back to back, you will hear Dr. Barry Trachtenberg, Professor of Judaic Studies at Wake Forest University, followed by Rabab Abdulhadi, the besieged Professor of Middle East Studies at San Francisco State University. As you will hear, it is an interesting pairing of speakers. The introductions are by Grant Smith of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, once again, good morning, and thank you for your patience as we try and stay on time and on schedule today. Our next panel addresses an issue at the very heart of our country's identity, the right to free speech. In an effort to control debate about Israel on college campuses and elsewhere, pro-Israel groups have increasingly sought legal measures to limit and even criminalize speech of those concerned about Palestinian human rights. Our two panelists, will offer insight into these efforts and will explain how to push back against First Amendment encroachments. Our first speaker is Dr. Barry Trachtenberg, the Michael R. and Deborah K. Rubin Presidential Chair of Jewish History at Wake Forest University. A scholar of Jewish history and of the Nazi Holocaust, Dr. Trachtenberg earned his PhD in history at UCLA and a postgraduate diploma in Jewish studies at Oxford University. Prior to joining Wake Forest in 2016, he was an associate professor and director of programs in Judaic Studies and Hebrew Studies at the State University of New York's University at Albany, and interim director from 2010 to 2012 of the University's Center for Jewish Studies. He's the author of two books, including the newly released 2018 book, The United States and the Nazi Holocaust, Race, Refuge, and Remembrance, which he'll be signing later today. On November 7th of last year, he testified before a House Judiciary Committee hearing on anti-Semitism on college campuses, which sought expert opinions on legislation that, if passed, would legally define anti-Semitism in a way that many fear is designed to curtail activity critical of Israel. Today, he will address challenging the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, pushing back against Jewish exceptionalist politics.
It's really an honor for me to be invited to speak here today. It's nice because at Congress, they give you a buzzer with just 5 minutes, and so it's nice to have 18 before the red light appears. It's really an honor for me to be on this panel with Rabab, who has been a model of scholarly activism on the issue of justice for Palestinians, and has been a target in an unrelenting campaign to discredit her and her work. So I'm very proud to be your warm-up act for today. So as we know, for several years, there's been a global campaign to thwart the nonviolent BDS movement. This has involved governments around the world, including, of course, Israel, but also the UK and France. And many state and local governments here in the United States have likewise declared that citizens risk being punished for choosing not to do business with Israel. We know that these statutes are a clear violation of free speech guarantees, and while they tend to not stand up to constitutional challenge, they're enacted by politicians who are pandering to what they incorrectly see as American Jewish voters' monolithic views of Israel. And although it's a nonviolent form of protest, the boycott is frequently equated with terrorism, and its supporters are cast as extremists and anti-Semites. And just a quick aside to sort of highlight the absurdity of this legislation. New York State, where I used to live, is boycotting North Carolina, where I now live, over the bathroom bill that discriminates against transgendered persons. And yet that same year, they passed anti-BDS legislation saying that boycotts are inherently discriminatory. So there you go. However, regardless of whether or not this sort of legislation is constitutional, the effect of it is to suppress criticism of Israel and thereby sustain the occupation of Palestinians. As a consequence, scholars and activists regularly engage in self-censorship, so reluctance to criticize Israel, for fear of being slandered, in some cases, for even having their livelihoods threatened and destroyed, as we know. The campaign against BDS has also been effective at distracting our attention away from focusing on the brutality of the occupation itself. As the scholar and activist Ayelet Ben-Yeshai has recently argued, while we argue about the merits of BDS, the occupation only intensifies, and too often we don't recognize our own complicity within it. As American taxpayers whose government sends billions in U.S. military hardware, as scholars whose universities set up strategic partnerships with Israeli universities and businesses, and speaking for myself as a professor of Jewish history whose professional organizations are likewise implicated in support for the occupation. Another front in this campaign to restrict freedom of political expression was the attempt by members of Congress in the last year to introduce legislation called the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, which would amend Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 by declaring that anti-Semitism is a violation under it. Now, on the face of it, the legislation looks encouraging, and one might reflexively be supportive, particularly since the rise of the Trump presidency, which has emboldened white supremacists to once again target Jewish communities. And it's for this reason likely that the measure sailed through the Senate in the last legislative session. Yet the truth is that this legislation is also an attempt to suppress student activism and academic speech that is in support of Palestinian human rights. The effect of this bill is to define opposition to Israel as anti-Semitism, to equate Judaism with Zionism, and to sanction schools who permit Palestinian human rights activism from occurring on their campuses. Yet, as with legislation against BDS, this act would likely not withstand constitutional challenges, but it too is already shaping how college campuses talk about anti-Semitism and contend with political activism against the occupation. Now, this legislation was prompted by growing activism on college campuses that challenged the Israeli occupation by groups such as Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace, who are often working to pass BDS resolutions on their campuses. Backers of this legislation, such as Anti-Defamation League, AIPAC, the Simon Wiesenthal Center, and Christian Zionist groups, have disingenuously portrayed campuses as ever more hostile and dangerous to Jewish students, and that American universities are hotbeds of anti-Semitism because of threats from pro-Palestinian activists. They've produced a set of academic studies, and I put that in quotes, that purport to document a rise of anti-Semitism on campuses. Yet a close reading of most of these studies demonstrates that in each of them, the researchers' definition of anti-Semitism includes activities that are critical of Israel and American complicity in the occupation. Given that student activism against the occupation is on the rise, these studies are more accurately read as a testament to the tenacity of pro-Palestine students than of rising anti-Jewish hatred. Now, to be clear, attacks on Jewish students for being Jewish are unquestionably repellent and must not be tolerated. The truth is that the old racist and religiously based anti-Semitism, such as we saw in Charlottesville this summer, where torch-bearing marchers carried Nazi and Confederate flags and chanted, "You Jews will not replace us," and murdered a protester, is still present in the United States and requires vigilance and persistence resistance. However, as their testimony before Congress attests, the backers of this bill care very little about combating white supremacy, for that would put them at odds with the current administration and supporters in Congress. It's not what this legislation addresses. It's primarily concerned with curbing political speech that threatens the continuing occupation of Palestine. The Anti-Semitism Awareness Act relies upon the State Department's classification of anti-Semitism, which is itself appropriated from the working definition of anti-Semitism of the European Monitoring Center on Racism and Xenophobia, a definition that was created for the purposes of research and not governmental policy. As well-intentioned as the State Department's concern for anti-Semitism may be, it defines anti-Semitism so broadly so as to include criticism of Israel as a Jewish state, declaring Israel to be a racist state, or by refusing to accept that Israel is an expression of Jewish self-determination. Even the author of the original working definition, the free speech advocate Ken Stern, who is opposed to the academic boycott of Israel, has testified that the definition was not drafted and was never intended as a tool or to target or to chill speech on a college campus. In fact, the State Department's definition upon which the legislation was based is so poorly constructed that it's entirely unusable. For example, it insists that an instance of anti-Semitism is, quote, accusing Jewish citizens of being more loyal to Israel or to the alleged priorities of Jews worldwide than to the interests of their own nations, unquote. This, of course, is one of the founding premises of Zionism. It's also one of the founding premises of the pan movements that emerged at the end of the 20th, in the beginning of the 20th century, such as pan-Germanism or pan-Slavicism. Later, we saw pan-Arabism or pan-Africanism. The first half of the 20th century in particular showed us that, as with other marginalized groups, Jews' citizenship in any particular country could not so easily be taken for granted. The founders of Zionism consequently concluded that regardless of where in the world they live, Jews have more in common with one another than they do with non-Jews. Such arguments can be traced back to the founder of Zionism himself, Theodor Herzl, who argued in his seminal 1896 book, The Jewish State, that anti-Semitism is an inescapable fact of modern existence, and Jews are a people, one people, and that for that reason, it's useful for us to be loyal patriots. Elsewhere, the definition states that denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination, denying Israel the right to exist, is an example of anti-Semitism. This, of course, ignores the plurality of views that exist within the Jewish community regarding Israel. As much as the ADL, AIPAC, and other groups testifying to Congress would like to assert, they are unequivocally not the spokesperson for all of American Jewry, a majority of whom feel that the U.S. should not support Israel's occupation of the West Bank. Indeed, since the first stirrings of Zionism in Europe, groups of Jews in America rejected Jewish nationalism. For some, it was a matter of faith. For others, it was out of loyalty to the United States. And for others, it was out of a commitment to universalist ideals of equality and human rights. For many Jews today and since 1948, the State of Israel is decidedly not an expression of Jewish self-determination. For another, the question of Israel's right to exist is not the same thing as its right to exist as a Jewish state if that existence is predicated on the displacement and oppression of the non-Jews within its borders. Given the flaws in the State Department's definition of anti-Semitism, it has no place in campus speech codes. Although discussions around Israel and Zionism may often be uncomfortable for its supporters and detractors alike, something that I witness in my classes most semesters, it's the responsibility of students and educators to foster dialogue and not to limit it, to understand the historical implications of our speech, and to allow for the meaning and definition of fraught terms to develop and change as a consequence of informed deliberation and debate. It's profoundly difficult to create a definition of anti-Semitism that can be used for legislative purposes. The root of the current debates on anti-Semitism lies in a seemingly intractable problem of how to critique Jewish collective power in a way that does not immediately resonate with a long history of anti-Semitism. Throughout the last 1,000 years of European history, Jews were regularly characterized as an incommensurate and exceptionalist element who sought to undermine the established religious, political, or economic order. They were accused of being killers of Christ and of seeking to repeat this offense through the murder of innocent Christian children. Such accusations at times led to blood libels, pogroms, first conversions, and exile. And in more recent centuries, Jews were characterized simultaneously as usurpers of national identities, as disloyal citizens, capitalist schemers, and revolutionary subversives. Such allegations led to discriminatory legislations, riots, expulsions, and physical violence. In the early 20th century, Jews were branded as a biological and racial threat, and entire armies rose up to exterminate them. In each of these moments, Jews were imagined as a united group that possessed power and authority far beyond their actual numbers. Yet in 1948, with the founding of Israel as a solution to anti-Semitism, the situation changed dramatically. For the first time, a significant number of Jews identifying as a national group gained actual and not military power. I'm sorry, not imaginary power. Today, the State of Israel has borders, police, courts, military, a nuclear arsenal, political parties, and a marginally democratic system, at least for its Jewish citizens. Like all other states, its actions are and must permitted to be a matter of public debate and discourse both within the Jewish community and outside of it. Yet speech that's critical of Israel strikes many still as inherently anti-Semitic. The problem in part is that we're still learning how to talk about Israel's actual power and repeated claims to represent Jews all over the world in ways that do not immediately echo much older and anti-Semitic depictions of imaginary Jewish power. This is in part because of the long history of anti-Jewish hatred in the West, But it's also because, as we see in legislative initiatives such as the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act and the Movement to Stop BDS, to characterize any speech that's critical of Israel as intrinsically anti-Semitic has been a highly effective tool employed by those who uncritically support every action of Israel and seek to stigmatize its critics. Considering the multiple and constantly shifting forms of anti-Semitism that have emerged since the term anti-Semitism first appeared in Germany at the end of the 19th century, it's wrong for Congress to establish legal authority on a definition of anti-Semitism that's so contested. To insist that Israel cannot be protested or objected to mandate that Jewish collective power cannot be analyzed or debated, or to conclude that Jews, because they were once victims of one of humanity's greatest genocidal crimes, are somehow immune from becoming perpetrators of acts of violence against other peoples, would only reinforce the anti-Semitic belief that Jews are a fundamentally different people. Moreover, and perhaps most dangerously of all, attempts to broaden the definition of anti-Semitism to encompass phenomena that are clearly not anti-Semitic can only make it more difficult to recognize, isolate, and oppose actual anti-Semitic hatred when it does appear. Although it appears that the legislation in Congress is stalled, it may be that its advocates will still get their way. Last month, Congress affirmed the appointment of Kenneth Marcus, an Israel lawfare strategist, the group that has been targeting Rabab, as head of the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights. Over the objection of Democrats and civil rights organizations and attorneys, Marcus will now be in a position to implement the State Department's definition and continue his decades-long effort to suppress academic speech and campus activism that's critical of Israel. So, to conclude, in the invitation letter, we were asked to offer some signs of hope in these difficult times. It's true, we were. So, the first piece I want to say is that during the break, I checked my phone and I saw the news that Bibi Netanyahu was just questioned today for 5 hours by the police. So, I take that as a good sign, you know. On the eve of the APAC conference, that seems to be a good thing, and, you know, Shabbat Shalom for that. But I think if we're serious about defeating actual anti-Semitism, we also have to commit ourselves to ending the occupation of Palestine. These are intertwined issues. These are intertwined struggles. We have to recognize that anti-Semitism doesn't exist in a vacuum and to stop thinking of it in these exceptionalist ways. Instead, we need to see that the history of anti-Semitism is part of the modern world's legacy of racial discrimination and persecution. And the present moment is no exception. Instead of perpetuating a narrative of Jewish exceptionalism by declaring that somehow the only country we cannot criticize on college campuses is Israel, we might instead draw from earlier periods of American history when Jews linked their fate to that of other oppressed peoples. Just as Italian and Jewish workers organized together to form labor unions, as Jewish philanthropists and community leaders contributed to the founding of the NAACP, as Jewish college students participated in voter recruitment drives and desegregation campaigns with African Americans in the South, and religious figures helped foster post-World War II Jewish-Christian dialogues in the name of mutual understanding, Jewish Americans have an opportunity to forge alliances in the name of combating hatred and intolerance. It was a coalition of Palestinian rights organizations, both Arab and Jewish, that came together to stop the advancement of the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act in the House. The very next day, on November 8th, a petition with over 20,000 signatures was delivered to the Anti-Defamation League by Jewish Voice for Peace, demanding that the ADL stop facilitating police trainings between Israeli and American law enforcement officials. That same day, Lawfare's suit against Rabab was thrown out by a judge who recognized the weakness of their complaint. So there are reasons to hope. We will keep fighting, continue working side by side with one another to create bonds of solidarity. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Dr. Rabab Abdulhadi. She's the director and senior scholar in the Arab and Muslim ethnicities and diasporas and associate professor of ethnic studies and resistance studies at San Francisco State University. She's a co-founder and editorial board member of the Islamophobia Studies Journal, for which she is co-editing the forthcoming special issue on gender, sexuality, and racism. She's co-author of Mobilizing Democracy, Changing U.S. Policy in the Middle East, and co-editor of Arab and Arab American Feminisms, Gender, Violence, and Belonging, which is for sale here today. Her work has appeared in 7 languages in academic journals, and she was the winner of the 2012 National Arab American Nonfiction Book Award. As many are you aware, and as was referenced, she and San Francisco State University have been the target of a Lawfare Project lawsuit claiming that the school fosters a hostile environment for Jewish students, but that case was thrown out by a judge in November. As her bio and work show, though, she has not let this smear campaign define her career, so we are pleased to welcome her to discuss how and why the Israel lobby is suppressing free speech and academic freedom on college campuses.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me. Washington Report on Middle East Affairs and the Institute for Middle East Research Policy. I also want to begin by acknowledging that we are convening on indigenous people's stolen lands. And I want to acknowledge the people, yes, I want to acknowledge the people who are fighting day in and day out against all forms of racism and racial discrimination, from the people who are fighting against white supremacy to the people who are fighting against anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, anti-Arab discrimination, as well as people who are trying to clean up Washington. Thank you for having me. So on last week, President Wang, San Francisco State University, issued a statement saying that Zionists are welcomed on campus. He had met with members of Hillel, and he basically came out with this statement that I can share the slide with people. For my presentation, I wanted to just answer a few questions. What does the statement mean to welcome Zionists to campus? What is the history behind President Wang's statement? How does it relate to our discussion of the Israel lobby, and where do we go from here? Immediately after President Wang issued the statement, I issued a statement right away saying that San Francisco State is abandoning its social justice mission by welcoming Zionists, and I called upon people to reclaim the social justice mission of San Francisco State as we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the 1968 San Francisco State's right. I also argued, as Barry has argued before me, that there is no equivalence between Zionism, Israel, and anti-Semitism. They're not one and the same. What happened also, in addition to my statement, is that there were multiple statements published that day. General Union of Palestine Students published. Black Student Union published a statement along with other black student groups on campus. A new group, Jews Against Zionism, has just emerged among students and published a statement. And Jewish Voice for Peace published a statement condemning President Wang's statement. This is something that we would not have seen 15 years ago or 11 years ago when I joined San Francisco State. This is something that's really important and also attests to the argument that Barry is making. Things are changing. The tide has turned, and I think we really need to keep that in mind. And when we know that the tide has turned, we know that the attacks are going to become more vicious and they will target us more and try to silence us. I also sent another statement last week, also citing the words of Richard Spencer, who said on Israeli TV that I'm a white Zionist, as well as Yair Netanyahu, the son of Netanyahu, who basically trashed people who argued and organized against the white supremacy in Charlottesville and said that actually organizers around Palestinian rights are more damaging to that. Obviously, we know where the alliances are. So meeting with Hillel, the president, what does Hillel stand for? And I would just read a couple of points. Wherever we stand with Israel. Hillel, actually, as a national organization that is involved in silencing us, does not allow Jewish students to belong to it who are for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. It is not allowed inside Hillel. One of the questions we are raising is, again, Zionism, Israel, and Jewishness are one and the same, or who owns Jewishness? Barry has talked about that, so I'm not going to get into it. But we have a history of silencing Palestine at San Francisco State. So what's going on with the Lawfare lawsuit that the judge dismissed on November 8th, but gave them leave to amend? So they may come back and amend, and they already said that they're going to be amending. The Lawfare Project is actually aided by a law firm in San Francisco that is almost 1,000 lawyers pro bono. I have two incredible, amazing pro bono lawyers who are standing by me day in and day out, and I would not change them for anybody. So we are fighting. And justice is on our side. That's really important too. But who is attacking Palestine at SFSU? It is what we call an Israel lobby industry network. As the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network report of 2015, it outlines who are some of these donors and the fact that the Israeli government also has put in millions of dollars in this. We're not talking about the cottage industry. We're talking about people who are quite organized. These are the list of the groups that I don't have time to go into it. The only two groups that have not directly attacked us, although we're getting public record requests, is the Brandeis Center, Kenneth Marcus, which I'm sure he's on the horizon somewhere. Friends of IDF have been involved, copied on emails, about attacking us, but they have not directly attacked us. Although we do have Israeli soldiers on campus that continue to be in active duty in the Israeli army. So we are calling this new McCarthyism, and the reason we're saying it's new, because it's exactly as McCarthyism in the 50s work. And what it does is that it attaches a terrorism label. It incites Islamophobia, uses Islamophobia by building Arabs, Palestinians, as Muslims are terrorists, so immediately it goes in people's minds. It engages anti-Semitic smear. It spreads misinformation and false allegation. The university invents new rules and regulations every single time they'd like to curb freedom of speech and our ability to organize and teach. And they police activists, organizers, and scholars. They try, as the Lawfare has done, as I will continue telling you, to ruin careers. Basically, the Lawfare co-founder, Brooke Goldstein, said that we are going to make the enemy pay in a video in 2016, in which she also said there are no Palestinians and Islamophobia does not exist, and also said that San Francisco State University is one of their main targets. So by trying to ruin my career, they would like to teach a lesson to other junior scholars and recent PhDs whose careers are on the lines. Watch out. This is what might happen to you. To silence people and engage in McCarthyist attacks to prevent people from speaking up, from organizing, from doing anything about justice. Basically, stay away from Palestine. They also, at San Francisco State, one of the main targets has been to starve and defund our program. That is part of my contract when I came to San Francisco State in 2007, and rely on donors, pro-Israel donors, who are pouring millions of dollars in the university and tell the university that we will continue funding you if you are able to discipline Palestinian students and silence Rabab Abdel Hadi and basically shut down the Ahmed Studies program. And one of the ways that they do it is backroom deals, lack of transparency, no accountability. A lot of this stuff is happening in secret, and they don't even release the public record FOIA request that we submit. They don't release, period. And the reason we actually have the public record request is because the university gave it to Lawfare, and my lawyers asked the university to just give us a copy of the public record that they gave to Lawfare, and they dragged their feet and finally gave us, and we don't know if they gave us everything, or they claiming that the officer who does the compliance is not in touch with other people. And you think with a such high-profile case in a federal court, the university lawyers would be watching the whole question of compliance at what's going on, but that's what they claim. I'm not going to give you all of this history, but this is from at least 2002. It goes, Palestine has been silenced, intimidated, bullied, criminalized, policed, and smeared at San Francisco State, both by organizations within and outside the university. So when we talk about a war of attrition has been declared. We're talking about groups outside of the university that are collaborating with groups within the university. So we don't see the two of them divorced from each other. In 2002, for instance, San Francisco State president, after sanctioning GOPS, Palestinian students, said, and they asked him to remove the sanction. He said, why? So you guys can go start throwing bombs in January? And he just actually said that's part of the university records. One of the things I really want to talk about is that in 2005-2006, the Palestinian students proposed to have a mural. San Francisco itself is known for murals. Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo lived in the Mission District, painted murals. San Francisco State has multiple murals on its walls. So Palestinian students wanted to build a mural. And this is the initial, this is the first rendition that was painted, proposed by two artists, Dr. Faya Kaweis, a Palestinian artist, and Dr. Susan Green, a Zionist Jewish artist. And if you notice on the side, on your left side, you see Handala, the cartoon character of Najil Ali, carrying a key. On it, it's written Al-Awda, return. And on the other hand, he's carrying a pen, because the pen also signifies the Palestinian saying, Al-Kalima al-Bundukiya, my word is my sword, that, or my gun. That words are really important to emphasize the intellectual value of learning and teaching in Palestine. Because when you don't have passport, the only thing you have is your education, right? And you don't have a state. And the San Francisco State University president opposed Handala, the key, and the Al-Awda. And he wasn't the only one. Jewish Community Relations Council and the Zionist organizations did. And he said that this cartoon in particular by Najil Ali, where the kid, the cartoon character, the non-existent cartoon character, throws a stone at the Israeli flag, actually gives him nightmares, makes him wear bulletproof vest, and has to have therapy. This is the final approval of Handala of the key. We had to remove in 2007 Handala, the key, and Al-Awda, and basically put in its place Sabr, cactus. The two things have happened. One is that the cactus is long living. It doesn't die. But two is that on the day of the unveiling of the mural, all Palestinian students and their allies came to the mural unveiling wearing T-shirts with Handala on them. And Handala now remains part of our oral history. In 2006, it continues with the JCRC also trying lobbying San Francisco State to not to have a conference of Al-Awda that was organized by students. In 2009, following the Gaza, 2008-2009 Gaza, a war on Gaza, San Francisco State College Republicans and the Israel team organized an event supporting Palestine, condemning Hamas. This was the approved poster. But this was the unapproved poster that went up that basically throws the shoes at La ilaha illallah Muhammad Rasulullah and says this is throw a shoes at Hamas flag and win prizes. The poster stayed up. Students took it down. Palestinian, Muslim, Black, Latinx, indigenous students, Asian, they all took it down. But the university, they're not going to take it down because there's freedom of speech. Watch out to see what else. After the second anniversary of the mural, when Omar Barghouti came to speak about BDS, San Francisco State President canceled searches we were conducting for two faculty lines to build the program. His chief of staff testified at the Board of Supervisors opposing the calls to lift the blockade of Gaza and obstructed a reception we were trying to do with diplomats from Arab and Muslim majority countries to ask them to send their children to our university to learn. The campaign escalates more in 2013, even though President Wong, the new president, met with the Arab community. After his investiture, he immediately took a trip, all-paid trip to Israel. And we were gearing up to the Ahmed proposal. So the linkage between this is that we were building the program. They have already canceled the searches. They have already starved the program. The program now ends up being one person, one faculty member with no operating budget, no staff, no other faculty. And now is the time to go for the kill. So the attack escalates because we were about to institutionalize the program. Because once the program is institutionalized, it doesn't matter. If you have person, you don't have person. It works. So in 2013, Israel lobby groups called Ahmed, Arab Muslim and Ethnicity and Diaspora Studies Initiative at the time, and Gobs accused us of glorifying the murder of Jews. San Francisco State President did not investigate but immediately condemned anti-Semitism. And for 7 months stayed silent when I was being attacked left and right. He also condemned speech, and he was reprimanded by free speech groups in San Francisco and collaborated with the Israeli consulate and the FBI in investigating students. In 2014, I was going on a sabbatical, and I led a delegation to Palestine, in which we began to talk with An-Najah National University about setting up a memorandum of understanding, collaboration, because our university president wanted the university to become a global university and engage with other institutions. So I was really acting upon his wishes, because I have relations with Palestinian universities. I don't really need to formalize them in order to have them happen. I was doing it. This is when, in the delegation, we met with Nabil al-Kurd and Sheikh Jarrah. We met, where is it? It disappeared. Okay. Anyway, it may be done. And then they started accusing me of terrorism, anti-Semitism, and also accused me of criminality, misuse of university taxpayers' funds to go to Palestine, because we're not allowed to be going and learning about Palestine. Taxpayers' funds should be used to build bombs and nuclear weapons and kill people and fund Israel and its occupation. And they demanded criminal investigation. I was audited by the College of Ethnic Studies, by the university administration, and every single audit came out saying that I did nothing wrong. All these allegations are unfounded. The university took 20 days to publish a public statement just to say these are the foundings. 20 days they resisted. And in the meantime, the lobby wasn't happy, so they petitioned the controller of the state of California to investigate me further. San Francisco State ordered 5-year audit of my international travel. Not a single question was about missing receipts or a penny. Every question was political. Why are you doing this? Why are you building? Why there is an MOU with An-Najah National University? What does this mean? Why does she travel to Palestine? At the same time, the provost revoked my trip to Palestine. That's a week before the State Department issued an advisory not to travel. So this was not as a result of the advisory. This was before the advisory. In the fall 2014, we passed the memorandum of understanding. The president and the provost meeting with the university, with the College of Ethnic Studies, we discussed how would the Ahmed Studies program would be supported. And the provost twice said to me, "We, in front of everybody, we do not fund Holocaust deniers." No reason. There is no reason. I teach actually the Holocaust and Jewish history and Jewish studies in all my courses and so on. But and President Want maintained silence. Nobody rose to my defense. We were able to approve the minor, but the Senate unanimously approved it in spring 2015. President Wang promised to reinstate the faculty lines, and we began to work on something called the Edward Said Scholarship. That was donated by one of the graduating students who wanted his university to have a scholarship so when his daughters go to the university, they can apply for it and have excellent education. The main resident, Zionist resident on campus, tried to obstruct the Edward Said scholarship, but Maryam Said, Wadi'a, and Najla intervened and made it happen, and we now have the Edward Said scholarship. In spring 2014, after we passed the minor, now we have a minor, we have the Edward Said scholarship, we have the memorandum of understanding. How are they going to get rid of us? I mean, there needs to be certain. So they escalate further attacks, and this happens during, we go on a delegation to Palestine, the prisoner, labor, and academic delegation. We hold two conferences, one with Bir Zeit University, one with An-Najah National University. We observe military tribunals of children who are being held in Israeli courts. We go to unrecognized Naqab, and we come back and we report. We build reporting and we issue a statement. So San Francisco, the university hosts Nir Barakat, the racist mayor of occupied Jerusalem, who slings a machine gun and calls for the killing of Arabs. So students attacked, went and protested, and other students organized a hunger strike. This is the delegation, and this is where we're meeting with the family of Muhammad Abu Khadir. Okay, now it's, why is it? Okay, this is the protest. Then we get put on the Canary Mission, myself and the students, and they give away their home addresses, their work. Some of our students receive sexual threats of violence. President Wang issued a statement to apologize to Nir Barakat and re-invites him to campus. In the summer, the university hires independent investigator who concludes that students, yes, did disrupt a speech, but it was against him and Israel, and there was no violence involved, and it was not about anti-Semitism. It was against Israel. In the fall of 2016, we have this past year attacks after attacks. Campus Watch, Middle East Forum launched a petition to demand that An-Najah, that the agreement with An-Najah ends. They call Palestinian universities terrorist universities. They quote Anti-Defamation League, by the way. They accused me of terrorism. Truth Revolt also calls for me to be fired. This is the petition. And then David Horowitz The Canary Mission put out wanted ads at, can I have 2 more minutes? Wanted ads, that basic wanted style ads that all over 26 posters were found. Students took them down. The police said there were no cameras. All of a sudden there were no cameras that day. And there was nothing, they saw nothing. Faculty was very supportive. Majority of organizations, I don't have time to say, this is part of a campaign. This is the lab. This is the poster that appeared on campus. All over campus, including on the garage of the administration building, that everybody in the administration went to park and saw the poster and did not do anything about them. We passed, during that period, we got 2 courses approved, the Palestinian mural as art of resistance at Edward Said. GOBS held its standing room only celebration of the mural. The students held weekly teach-ins to protest the coming of Trump. This is the anniversary, the mural anniversary. Come on, okay. And in February, they held a Know Your Rights Fair, which is now also under investigation and attack. And they also organized events to support Palestinian prisoners who were on hunger strike in April. On May 3rd, we have another set of posters, wanted style ads, second set of posters appearing on campus. And in June, the lawfare lawsuit that you've heard about, and I actually only found out about it from Campus Watch tweets because nobody in the university bothered to tell me. And I was not appointed a lawyer until a month afterwards. That's why I sought and found my lawyers. We refused to be derailed. We organized a big conference on Constitution Day with co-organized with other colleagues at the university, and we had very big participation. But on September 21st, Horowitz again puts new, this is the posters. Okay, and let me just go back. Yeah. What's the response? This is what the students, associated students, did. They put up the Palestinian flag. They published posters, hate speech is not free speech. They said, we will not be silent. And we will not be silent. What we do, we continue to do. We continue to teach our classes that are full to the capacity. We continue to do with no resources, public education programs, using the classrooms to bring the community, the faculty, the students, multiple people together to organize every single day, and we continue to teach Palestine. And I'm very proud to announce that in 2 weeks we will be holding 2 conferences at Bir Zeit University and Najah National University on teaching Palestine, pedagogical praxis, and the indivisibility of justice. Because we will not be silenced. We will not be stopped. We will not be derailed. Justice will prevail. Thank you.
You have been listening to Dr. Barry Trachtenberg, Professor of Judaic Studies at Wake Forest University, and Dr. Rabab Abdulhadi, Professor of Middle East Studies at San Francisco State University. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To hear the program later in the day, we realize 8 a.m. on Sunday morning is awfully early for some, or to listen to the program at any other time of the week via the archive found on WZBC homepage, simply click on Archive, go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. However, each program is on this archive for only 2 weeks. After 2 weeks, to reach our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. It is all there. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.